Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Juan Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Castle Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're going to give you the inside track on food, wine, and fine things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Register at restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. Doing very well, with the exception of some bad news that's out there.
Yeah, we have a follow-up for you. We had reported earlier that the Food and Drug Administration, which is run by a lot of ex-executives from food and drug companies who are spending a little time running the Food and Drug Administration before they go back to becoming executives for food and wine companies. But don't worry, they're there to protect you.
They're protecting us from nothing.
They had been considering whether or not to allow cloned meat to be produced or to be sold, and they have made their decision. Unlike Europe now, we can, if they clone an animal, we can eat, they can sell the food, the milk, the eggs, the
but
meat.
Here's what we've
on
done.
The market.
You know what? And if you want to eat cloned meat, and you know, somebody asked me this question the other day. Somebody said, you know, you're really against the cloned meat thing. Do you have any evidence to say that cloned meat is worse? And I don't have evidence to say cloned meat
is worse.
And
let me make a distinction here before we go forward. We're not talking about genetically modified organisms, mm-hmm. because I believe there is evidence against genetically modified
right.
organisms. Now, so I'm vehemently against, we shouldn't be allowing genetically modified
Correct.
Agricultural products free in the environment. But
Correct.
We'll get to that another time. We're just talking about cloned animals here.
So, you know, I don't have any information, but the answer I gave to the person was, but neither does the FDA.
Well, they have some information, but certainly not enough. And a lot of very serious groups are saying these things haven't been around long enough and haven't been studied outside the laboratory long enough to make a determination. But the meat companies and the cloning companies want there to be a determination, and so that's what we got.
So now we're able to eat these animals, okay. The fact that passed, you know what, I don't care that much. If you want to eat cloned meat, you want to, and it's cheaper for whatever reason, or you think it's better for whatever reason, I don't care that much. For me, the crux of this and the problem I have with this is they will... As usual, they've passed it so that you don't have to label the meat as cloned beef. So, simply put, cloned beef will become part of your everyday meat repertoire if you're a meat eater, whether you like it or not.
And what they're saying is, the FDA is saying, well, we need to let the market decide. But if the market doesn't have the information, the market can't decide. So... You know, and let me just clarify what they're talking about doing here. They're talking about taking their best producing or cattle with the best attributes, the attributes that they like the most, and rather than letting that animal normally sexually reproduce,
where
you would have beef from a strain of cattle, they're talking about cloning the animal. And since cloning is so expensive, not necessarily slaughtering that animal, but having that animal be sold
right.
so that the
sire
natural
other
right. So these are the offspring of these cloned animals. Now let's look at the logic of what the FDA is saying here. They're saying that while in many instances cloned animals, they're saying, well, cloning it's proven it should work, it should be easy, right? Okay, well, a cloned animal should be identical to the healthy animal from which it was cloned. Except that many more than would occur in nature, instances of cloned animals result in the fetus aborting.
Mm-hmm.
They result in sickly animals being either not surviving birth or shortly after birth dying or dying young. And even that first cloned sheep was put to sleep early due to lung problems that were not it did not exist in the original cloned sheep.
Apparent in the first sheep.
But when they come out looking healthy, like Dolly the clone sheep, the FDA is saying, well, the ones that come out and look healthy are healthy. We know that because they look healthy, and they're exactly the same. Except that it doesn't work most of the time. So what about, so how can you say that it works when we know that sometimes it doesn't work? So how can we know that the one that looks healthy doesn't have something else that's not negative about it?
It's simple. We just don't know. Okay, we just don't know. I'm not, I don't want to bash the whole cloned meat market because maybe it's some, maybe it's the wave of the future, but we don't know. And why can't I have my meat labeled? And that's basically what it's going to come down to. I presume, and I'm presuming here, that it will become a problem if you try and say my meat is not from cloned animals.
Well, and it's
which much like you're not allowed to test for mad cow.
But
And advertise that you've tested for mad cow.
And it's not just meat, it's milk as well. And the meat and milk will not be from a genetically modified animal. It will become from the traditionally it will not be from a cloned animal. It will be from the litter, the animals that come from the cloned animal. So I guess what I'm saying is, as a consumer, if what Mark wants to do is say, you know what, I'll let your children eat this meat and drink this milk. And 25 years from now, if nothing's wrong, I'll have egg on my
face. I'll give it a shot. Sure. I'll save 25 cents a liter.
Or maybe Mark's saying, you know what, I don't believe in cloning. I don't think we should do that. And so I'm going to choose to spend my dollars on non-cloned meat. And what they have now is...
I mean, there's a whole... I mean, even for religious reasons. What if I don't want to eat cloned meat for religion because I believe it's morally wrong to clone an animal? I just don't understand what the issue with labeling foods is. Why do we have such a problem in this country with labeling our food?
Well, and the thing is, with the cloned animals, there's a voluntary moratorium, and we believe there would be voluntary labeling. But, you know, when it's voluntary, American industry doesn't really do things like that a lot, and it winds up being very expensive. So it's the same with genetically modified organisms. Why in the world? In Europe, if you use genetically modified organisms in anything, it has to say GMO and carry a little label that says it's GMO.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the meat producers, the cereal producers and the producers of products that you know, use genetically modified corn or canola, say, well, there's no difference. Why should we have to put it on there? Well, evidently there is a difference because the consumers don't want your stuff. And don't the consumers have a right to know? We're not saying it's not allowed on the supermarket shelves.
That's
saying,
true.
Don't the consumers have a right to know? And what they're saying now is, well, and it's a wonderfully circular argument. These producers of genetically modified organisms are saying Europe, which currently doesn't accept unlabeled genetically modified organisms, should have to accept genetically modified food products and not label it. And they use as an example that the American market has accepted it because in 70 or 80% of our food products, we have genetically modified organisms.
Right.
Basically, most of the corn out there that goes into the high fructose corn syrup or the corn flour is genetically modified. So they're saying as an argument, we'll see, the American market accepts it, but the American market only accepts it because you tricked us into it.
Right, because you don't know better, because you don't know if your cornflakes has it or your Coca-Cola has it or not.
Well, you know, that's where we stand on this. It's truly unfortunate that it's going through and doesn't need to be labeled at the very least that you can have stuff from cloned animals. But it's really nothing new. So we got to keep knowing where our food comes from and fight the good fight. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk with one of the best winemakers in the world, Mr. Paul Hobbs, from his home in California. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking today with an old friend, one of the most sought-after and famous winemakers in the world, a gentleman by the name of Paul Hobbs. He has Paul Hobbs Winery in California, Viña Cobos in Argentina. He's working on projects in Hungary and Chile as well. Our favorite flying winemaker, Paul Hobbs.
Paul, welcome to the show.
Mark, Francis, it's great to be back. How you doing?
We're doing great. Good to talk to you again, my friend.
Thank you. Good.
Now, in the shameless plug portion of things, we should point out that you are coming to do a wine dinner at one of our restaurants at Stage Left on the 30th of January. So that should be coming up, right?
That's correct. I'm really looking forward to it. We do it every year, and I love this this venue. So yeah, looking forward to it.
Now, do you do wine dinners a lot? I mean, do you find that you do these?
Nope. Very few, in fact. No more, I would say, a maximum of five per year.
Uh-huh. And some of those are in Argentina? Is this?
Yes, actually, truly. I mean, Argentina or Brazil would make up a couple of those that I do in the year. So in the States, I would typically, you know, yours and two or three others, perhaps, would make up the year.
Now, let's talk about, I think a lot, now, you've been on the show before, but some of our listeners may not have heard of your show before. Let's talk about how you can be so intimately involved with, because you are really intimately involved with making the wine, not just the owner of a vineyard, you know. So how can you do that in so many different places?
Well, as you know, I love being in the vineyard. And how do I do it in so many places? Well, I have the privilege of, I've been working in Argentina and Chile, actually, Argentina since 1989 and Chile since 1992, Argentina with Catena and Chile with Valdivieso. And one good thing is they're off-season. They're in the, you know, southern hemisphere, so...
Opposite climates, opposite seasons, as we
absolutely
have.
That makes it doable. Otherwise, you know, I'd be competing with the work that I do in the northern hemisphere here in California. Mm-hmm. And I do some work in Hungary, but even that work... I'm working mostly in Tokaj, but also in the southern part of Hungary in Vilány. And the Tokaj region picks later than California, so I usually can wrap up here late October, early November, and get there. The season actually legally doesn't start until October 28th, the harvest season, and then goes into the first snows in December, so I can be there for that. So I think partly Mother Nature set it up to be make it convenient for me.
She's considerate that way. Now let's talk about you make your wines aren't certainly not inexpensive from California, but they are rated among the best in the country. And we've been pouring your wine since your first vintage, your 91 Cab. And I think that, you know, the Paul Hobbs wines are a given, and we can talk about them more a little later. But let's talk about Argentine wines. I mean, there's been a real revolution in wines from Argentina.
No pun intended.
And the Mendoza Valley in the last, 15 years?
I was thinking you're going to say there's a real coup, because
no.
That's typical of South America.
Careful. Yeah, but we don't say that. So when is it the revolution really come about in Latin American wines?
Well, I think it's correct. I mean... that what you say, that there has been a revolution or a renaissance, because I think at one time Argentine wines, well, maybe they never were truly heavily exported, but they were making better wines in the 30s. Their industry kind of grew at that time with a seedbed of a lot of Italian immigrants and some Spanish immigration in the 30s. But then the country became an isolationist policy and didn't open up again until 1989, 1990, and so it really happened then. I think that Argentina realized that it had to sell wine internationally. Not only wine, but I mean, their economy had to become part of the international global economy. So I think that was a big shift in thinking that occurred in the beginning of the 1990s. And I happened to be just by chance in Chile, and then meet Nicolas Catena in 1988, and so we got the ball kind of rolling with Nicholas's vision to really step up the quality in Argentina. At that time, most of the wines were very oxidized. In fact, they were all oxidized and cooked wines. They had beautiful vineyards in Argentina and some very old Malbec vineyards that, I didn't even know what Malbec was until I got to Argentina.
Which is a type of grape.
It's a type of grape, one of the Bordeaux 5.
But, I mean, Paul, when we met in 1992, you were talking about the vineyards of Argentina back then. You were talking about, you know, how you felt that they were some of the best vineyard land in the world.
Yes, that's right. Well, I was stunned. You know, I'm waiting for you gentlemen to come down there and see it with your own eyes with me at some time and eat one of those big, juicy, gorge yourself on one of those big, juicy steaks.
Well, I'll tell you what. On January 30th, we will make an appointment to come down to Argentina and spend some time with you down there.
That's great news.
So, but What happened with the wine? It was a revolution in wine making, in that it went from making these mediocre wines to making some world class wines, and you had a hand in that from the very beginning. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more with Paul Hobbs about wine in Latin America and how it's now one of the must have categories on any wine list. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with Paul Hobbs, who makes wine on three continents, but we're talking specifically about Argentina and wines from Latin America in general. So we were talking before the break, and you're saying that, you know, they have these wonderful vineyards down there. Why had this style of Argentine winemaking sort of fallen to this, you know, making large quantities of mediocre wine? And even internally in Argentina, they weren't making really top-quality wine like you would think they would.
Yeah.
Why had that happened?
Well, it happened during the period of isolationism when, really, people didn't think about, they didn't have any reference of quality or benchmark. And, you know, what in the 1930s, again, I go back to that period because that was actually their heyday, and it was the eighth largest economy in the world, I think, and they had a very high standard of living. Or maybe I have it wrong. Maybe they're the eighth highest standard of living, but they were importing a lot of French wines and so on, but all that ended, it almost like went dark there, I would say, for 40 years. And so they were just making plunk, and that was, you know, what Nicolas Catena wanted to do was to get out of doing that. But as I mentioned, the quality of fruit they had, all it took was updating the machinery. They had such ancient equipment. It's like you wouldn't expect to find such old equipment and such dilapidated equipment in a museum.
Really? And so was it just a matter of changing the equipment, or did you have to change the style and the palate of the winemakers?
And the mindset.
And the mindset as well.
Well, you know, one thing that I appreciate greatly about, that I didn't recognize then, I only recognized when I went to Hungary, is that the Argentine winemakers and vineyard managers and viticulturists, those people are very well trained. And so they know wine, they know basics. I mean, they didn't really understand how to manage the malolactic fermentation or some aspects, or barrel fermentation. They had very little idea what to do with a barrel. In fact, they didn't have barrels. They had large vats and things of that nature. But they did understand the basics of wine, the fundamentals. And I've had a much more difficult time, if you can believe it, in Hungary, finding qualified people that understand basic analysis. And, you know, it's sort of like before you become a doctor, you have to take some basic courses so you understand chemistry and
anatomy.
Sort of thing. You just build the foundation, right? Anatomy and, yeah, all this sort of thing. I find that got lost in Hungary under similar conditions. That was communism.
I want to come back and talk about two different winemaking regions that sort of went dark and are experiencing true enlightenment as we speak, Hungary and Argentina. We'll talk more about that after the news. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Capital Party Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with our friend Paul Hobbs. Paul is one of the most accomplished and sought-after winemakers in the world. He makes wines on three continents. In the United States, we have Paul Hobbs Winery. We also have Viñas Cobos down in Argentina. He's also making wine in Hungary and Chile. We had briefly touched on the idea that when the Argentine economy after the 30s became an isolationist economy, the wine culture there, as so much of the culture there, sort of went dark for a while with a comparison to outside influences and the ability to make great wine. Yeah. You're also making wine in Hungary, where Hungary was known for its sweet and its dry wines, but especially for its sweet wines, as the winemaking capital of Eastern Europe. And with the advent of communism after World War II, it also went dark for about 40-some-odd years and is experiencing a renaissance or an enlightenment. Those are some pretty strong parallels, don't you think?
Uncanny. Very strong, and in some ways there's great similarities. Hungary is such an exciting area. I mean, Tokaj, for example, is such geological diversity. We had some French soil specialists there not long ago, and they were just, I mean, it was like the proverbial kid in a candy store situation. They have never seen such incredible diversity of soils, and frankly, I haven't either. So it's a very exciting region, but there's it's like a place that's been frozen in time. Nothing has happened for like 40 years there, and so it all has to be rebuilt.
Without getting too eggheady, tell us why the diversity of soils might be important.
Well, the thing that it just gives so much more complexity to the wine and so much more depth, as you well know. So these kind of different soils can really add a lot of character and flavor, and that's what I've been seeing in the wines. Now, the varieties they have to work with for making sweet wines are terrific. You know, the famous Tokaj Azu wines, Esencias, and so on, you know, that are infected by the Botrytis cinerea mold and then concentrated in make a delicious sweet wine. I'm not so sure, you know, the region feels to survive in the wine world today, it's going to need to also make dry wines. And I think that's correct thinking as well. But they're trying to do it with the indigenous varieties that they would use for sweet wines. And that thinking, I think, could be problematic.
Wasn't there a historical precedent, though, in Hungary for dry wines from various regions of Hungary?
Yes, and in some ways they're better, in other ways they're worse than the conditions that I found in Argentina back in 1989. So most of the dry reds that are being made in Hungary today, and some of them are very pricey. They don't sell outside of Hungary, but nationalism has commanded some very high prices. If you're a famous winemaker in Hungary, you can basically charge $60, $70, $80 a bottle for wine that no one on the international market would pay more than $5 or $6.
Paul, whenever you go to Hungary, you're a famous winemaker in Hungary.
Well, no, now, when you say that, is it that the wines are flawed?
Yes.
But they capture sort of the imagination of, you know, Hungarian pride, and that's why they'll get that much money?
I think so. You know, I've been in some of their cellars, and if we were to walk through their cellars one day, you would see immediately what I'm talking about. Your nose would detect the problem before you even, as you approach the cellar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're like science projects, and microbiological science projects are more like a cheese factory. They're not well maintained. I don't mean it, and that's a bad cheese factory. I mean, so.
But I've even experienced some of those problems in some of the famous winemaking regions of France. I mean, you go into a cellar or a cave, and there are issues.
Well,
I wanted you to know nothing compared to what I've seen in Hungary. I mean, I too have traveled. I've never seen anything like it. I mean,
well, let's bring our listeners on board. When you're making wine, you're making a product that's, you know, it's an agricultural product, and there are a lot of chemical reactions that go on. So what happens is you take your grape juice and you introduce yeast or various types of yeasts, or you very carefully allow the yeasts that are on the grapes to start a fermentation process, and that's actually a very complex process that's affected by temperature, the other things that are ambient in the air, whether or not, and here's the key, whether or not the cellar is clean or dirty. And in any good winery, you will find that it's very, very clean and sterile. And there are a lot of parts of that that are kept in a sterile environment. And what you're saying, Paul, is you're seeing that not be the case. It's as if Pasteur did not exist.
Yeah, now, not every winery, but that's one of the problems. And the other problem is, of course, that they really don't have a sense of what good viticulture is.
Well, you know, it's funny because that's one of the things that I think is a great challenge. I remember, I mean, here in New Brunswick, where Mark and I have our restaurants and where we went to college, there's a very large and wonderful Hungarian population. There's a lot of Magyar spoken around here. In fact, the bank that holds the mortgage on one of our restaurants is called Magyar Savings Bank. You know, there's a lot of Hungarian pride here for various reasons. A lot of folks came over after the 56 uprising that was unsuccessful in Hungary and settled around here. And, you know, I remember I rented a house in New Brunswick from a family called the Ugris, and they were very wonderful, rented us their home. And the one thing that Anna told me that I wasn't allowed to touch was her wine grapes. And she had one row growing along the back fence on the left.
About 78 grapes a year.
Right, exactly. Making a case a year, maybe. But she had reds on the left and whites on the right. And she said to me with a thick accent, she's a wonderful woman, she said, "This is my Tokaj," which is a famous Hungarian wine, made from the grape ferment. And this is my...
She had ferment?
No. She said, "This is my Tokaj."
Okay, and this is my Tokaj.
Right, but it wasn't ferment, it was... Catawba, which is a which is a terrible East Coast grape, and this is my Bikaver, which means bull's blood, which is a type of wine from Eger, which is where
You know Eger.
So, wow. And that was the noble red wine of historical Hungary, and that was Concord grapes, but. The thing was,
which is what, I told you not to make me laugh.
Which is basically what we make grape jelly out of, right, here in the United States.
But here's the thing: these are people who are displaced from their country and are trying to reclaim a glorious past, and they have a very rich history that includes winemaking. And so, you know, for her, that was her Bikaver, and that was her Tokaj. So, but when you have 40 years where the great Tokajs and the great Bikavers weren't there anymore, you sort of lose that frame of reference. And if what you're telling me, Paul, is that in Hungary, sort of mediocre schlocky wines that carry the right name can be getting $50-$60 a bottle, that's another battle you have to fight to make quality wine, because it seems as though, at least for those people, the quality of the wine isn't the determining factor.
Exactly. And that's the challenge, is that some of them already think they're doing great things. But, you know, all these things will change. And fortunately, the people that I have the privilege to work with do know wine internationally, and so they have a global perspective, and they realize the problem, and so they have invested millions of dollars in a new winery and facility. That's, in fact, we have a young woman that works full time there from Chile, a Chilean winemaker. She's very good, and so for the last 2 years, we've been making some beauties, and so I'm very excited about the future. For good dry red wines, and what I really like about them is they're so distinctive.
Well, you know, this leads to another question that I want to ask you. If we've lost that tradition of wine making, people call it developing a palate, you know, where we all know what the wines have been like for the last several years, so we know what to expect in them coming. How do you make in Hungary a traditional Hungarian wine, or a wine that expresses the soil of Hungary in a traditional way, when those wines haven't been around in so long? How do we know what they're supposed to taste like?
Well, right. I mean, if you look at history to tell you, then, of course, there's no way to know. However, I think the way we make wine today, we do everything we can imagine to respect the character, what we call terroir.
Terroir meaning the sense of place.
Yeah, the sense of place. So that if you're tasting a wine from the region, there's something about it that you can tell it's from there. And that's what makes it exciting. That's why we do native fermentations mostly, and we don't use too much oak, and we do everything very respectfully, and we put all the effort into growing high quality fruit. Just like in your business. In the restaurant business, you want great quality raw ingredients to work with. So we need the same.
It's super important.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk more with Paul Hobbs about his winery ventures in South America, in the United States, and in Hungary. You can catch Paul at a wine dinner at our restaurant coming on the 30th of January and meet him yourself and taste some rare vintages. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:46. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis. Today, talking with Paul Hobbs, owner of Paul Hobbs Winery in California, Viña Cobos in Argentina, and also we've been talking about his projects in Hungary.
Paul's recently got some really good news that I'm sure he's much too modest to mention, but I'm not too modest to mention for you. Paul's gotten basically his Viña Cobos, his flagship wine from the Viña Cobos Winery, Cobos, has been rated as the highest rated wine ever to come from South America. Recently got 100 points from Robert Parker in barrel tasting for his 2006. These are some really, really world-class, extraordinary wines coming from Argentina, and I do think that still surprises some people, Paul.
Yes, well, we're very thrilled. Thank you, Mark. I mean, it's the first issue of the Wine Spectator to ever fully carry a segment on the Argentina was this most recent one, which was out just at the end of the year 2007, and so it's a whole section in that issue along with the California ratings that they've devoted to Argentina. That's the first time that's ever happened. So this has been it's like an affirmation, if you will, and so it's very thrilling. After 15, 16, well, I guess 17 or 18 years now that I've been working down there to finally get to this point and be a part of that, as you've mentioned, is exciting for me.
Well, again, Paul, Paul's being modest here. Paul has basically been the lead pioneer on the fine wine movement in Argentina over the last 20 years. So congratulations to you for that, Paul.
Thank you.
I think it's interesting, though. Your style of making wines is, I think, somewhat more reserved than a lot of folks in everywhere that you make wine, where I think people kind of go for power. That's very obvious.
And not that your wines aren't powerful, because they are.
Right, but I mean, think people go just for power in wines that make it very obvious and tend to get high scores right out of the gate. I think with all your wines, it's been kind of a slow burn. Like, people sort of notice you, and then the public has come to realize your wines are great over time. And I remember when your wines were first, you had a distributor change and your wines became more widely available in New York. And a couple of my friends said, yeah, I like those Paul Hobbs wines, but do you think they're ageable? And then I would strangle them and say, yes, I've had them for 7 years and the most ageable wine. But it has been a slow burn from you. It was not right out of the gate for you. What was that like?
Yeah, well, it's in a way, I prefer that, just because usually wine is a product that takes some time to get to know. In fact, and many years to kind of dial it in, and so, I mean, I see even some of my colleagues or some that have worked with me or I've trained, then they go off on their own and they're immediately like getting a lot of recognition, and I think one has to be careful not to get too much too fast in the business. Whether they're really good and they'll maintain it or not, and I hope they do, of course.
Well, Paul, I'm going to congratulate you, but I think that one of the things that happened here is the critics caught up to you, because in the beginning, your wines always got good scores, but they didn't get great scores. And yes, I think your wines have evolved, and yes, I think that, some of your vineyards have evolved as well, but at the same time, your wine stylistically don't seem that different to me. It seems like maybe the critics have caught up to your style.
I would say to some degree, I don't make wine for critics, that's for sure. You know, it's weird. I even heard that, well, there's this famous thing out here about Ojai Winery, and apparently the winemaker said he was making wines for Robert Parker, and he was getting big scores. Now he says he can't drink his wines. I go, my God, this guy, I never, I mean, this is sad.
The winemaker was saying basically he was making wines that he really didn't like, but he knew they would get good scores.
Yeah. What a hypocrite is all I can say.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff.
I mean, you got to make, I mean, I think that's, I like what you said when you say, you know, if you're making good wine and people like it, I mean, you just can't make what you like all the time. But basically, if you really like what you're doing and you do make good wine, people will come to recognize it. And I like the idea that the critic catches up with you, because rather than making it for the critic, which happens a lot, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it really does. So what's next on the horizon? What's our next port of call?
Well, I'd like to take you over to Armenia one of these days. That's where I'm going. We've been talking now with a project in mind for, well, since October, really, but I'm going to go there and make my first visit in May.
They make wine in Armenia?
Yeah. I don't know much about it, Francis.
My guess is you're going to find out, though.
I have a feeling, and then it's just a matter of whether or not that's, like every other place, whether it's exciting or not. But I have tasted a couple of really old wines. One was like a 1928. These were sweet wines, or like semi-fortified wines, or were delicious. We tasted with some sommeliers in San Francisco.
Well, I remember 2 years ago you came on the show, Paul, and I said, you know what, check out this Hungarian thing for us and come back to us and let us know how it's going. So, you know what, check out this Armenian thing for us and come back and let us know how it's going.
So you're trying to take credit for that, Mark? Is that
No, I don't think so.
I'd like you guys to come with me. That's the thing.
All right. You need some traveling companions? I fit in very large luggage.
Oh, you like first-class accommodations.
No, he's saying he would fit in the luggage.
Oh, luggage.
But I do like first-class accommodations. I cannot tell a lie.
Hey, listen, Paul, we need to leave it there, but we look forward to seeing you on the 30th, and we'll try some of your wines with dinner, and we'll further this with some select friends who choose to join us.
Excellent. Francis, Mark, thank you very much.
It'll be great as always, I'm sure.
Looking forward to it.
If you want to find out more about Paul Hobbs Wines or Paul Hobbs Winery, you can go through restaurantguysradio.com. You can also check out the dinner we're doing with him coming up. He has a number of different wines. Not all of them bear his name, but they're worth looking into. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Paul Hobbs. You know, one thing that is when Paul comes out for this wine dinner that I really enjoy is he's going to come with his daughter, Augustina.
Mm-hmm.
Augustina is, let's see, let me do the math, 10,
94.
11, 12, 13, 14.
14, there you go.
And I remember when Augustina was born, because in 94, Paul named a wine after his newborn daughter, Augustina Hobbs.
Le Cuvée Augustina.
And I have to say, I'm 42 years old, getting older in this business. I remember that was when we had the Cuvée Augustina that came out in 96, because mm-hmm. it was a 94 wine, came out 2 years later. And I remember that, you know, I would go and visit Paul whenever I was out in California. I'd stop by. And now Augustina of the Cuvée Augustina frame is going to be here herself.
Uh-huh.
And she can walk in on her own. And she's actually a charming young lady.
She has become quite the charming young lady.
Well, and you
sure.
know, to mark the passage of time, I mean, it's amazing to me that we have some original Cuvée Augustina. Mm-hmm. And that was the year that she was born. That was on the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're old. But the wine's still doing great. Mark and I are getting a little creaky.
Augustina is still young, so we're not that old.
Actually, it's interesting because she gets to travel with her dad because obviously the seasons are reversed. So she's on mm-hmm. break from school, and she often comes and will come to the dinner. And she is multilingual, articulate, charming, charming young lady. So she's turned out as well as the Augustina wine.
And they're still, you know, Paul still produces a Cuvée Augustina every year, and he chooses them, obviously, as it's his only daughter. He chooses it. Only his finest wines go into his Cuvée Augustina.
I do think that the wine dinners are interesting. I mean, we did one with a German winemaker just recently. We've attended other folks' wine dinners. And I think that the opportunity to sit down and, you know, we have this idea that we go to the wine store and we taste a little bit of wine and then we buy it. And you taste four different things and then you make a purchase. That's really not the best way to judge wine. And I think that when you have the opportunity to sit down with the winemaker or with some intelligent folks who know about that wine and have it over time with food and drink a glass of it.
It's a totally different perspective. First of all, having the winemaker there, anytime you notice some nuance, and this has happened a million times in the restaurant, there's some nuance. There's something in the wine that stands out for whatever reason. I remember George Hendry's wine had some peach notes to it. It was like, oh yeah, that wine's right next to the peach orchard.
Yeah, isn't that wild? Isn't that wild? All right, well, I hope that you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.